This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Africa spends between $35 and $44 billion a year on debt service costs. If we can get the, call it $40 billion a year, and not paid, it is money that stays on the continent, and that money can be used as part of the initiative to fight the COVID pandemic.
That's South Africa's former finance minister, Trevor Manuel, on the African Union's pursuit of debt relief and other aid to help countries deal with the COVID challenges. Details coming up also. Burundi is set to swear in its newly elected president tomorrow. And Uganda's Electoral Commission has banned mass rallies ahead of general elections to stem the spread of COVID-19. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Scientists say COVID-19 could kill up to 50,000 people in South Africa by November. Infections and fatalities are rising fast as the pandemic begins to peak in Africa's most developed economy. In Johannesburg, correspondent Darren Taylor spent time with a counselor who's been helping relatives of people who have died due to the coronavirus.
We live in a world where death is something that we must avoid, or we must fight, or we must put off at all costs in order to have more life.
Cameron Hogg's been counseling terminally ill patients and the relatives of people who've died for decades. Relaxing music fills the room where he works, wearing a white caftan and surrounded by antique furniture and walls of pastel colors.
Death from COVID-19 is a traumatic death. It's not like having a terminal illness. It's a different kind of dying.
It's different because the possibility of infection prevents relatives from spending time with their loved ones. They can't touch them. At best, they see them through plastic sheets. They can't talk with them face to face. They can't say the goodbye they want.
So if we look at someone dying in a car accident or someone dying on their own from COVID, our mind can't make sense of it. And we feel it much more than the person experiencing it. The way we manage bereavement needs to be different because death in a traumatic situation has not allowed for some of the conversation that might have taken place in just a terminally ill patient.
This morning, we wake South Africans up with sad news that we now have our first death resulting from COVID-19.
This means that there are further deaths that have been reported, especially in the Western Cape and the Free State.
In the last 24 hours, coronavirus-related fatalities have gone up by 4, bringing the total number to...
Since March, South Africans have been turning on their TVs to numbers. Numbers of infected, numbers of dead. Hogg says being surrounded by death is causing high levels of anxiety and even panic.
The downside of all this publicity around COVID-19 is that it triggers an inflamed sense of survival. So when mortality is so in our face, instead of looking at death with a new approach, we look at how am I going to survive? And the fear levels then rocket because people are working out, how am I going to continue paying my bills? Will I have a career? Will I have a job? Will I have a life? How am I going to?
These are all valid, sensible questions, says Hogg. And while we can't stop the hype around the virus, we can change our attitude toward it.
One of the challenges this whole experience has given all of us is to be still, to be patient and to be present in the moment.
But he adds, some South Africans have clearly failed the challenge. They moan about the lack of sports, that bars, restaurants and nightclubs are closed.
We find it really difficult not to be constantly entertained, not to be constantly occupied. We don't know how to be still. And we react incredibly to being limited, to being told we can't do something.
Hogg believes the pandemic has exposed the true state of humanity.
We are the most materialistic we have ever been in the history of mankind. And as a consequence of that, we want more and more and more. There's never enough of anything. There's not enough money, there's not enough food, there's not enough alcohol, and there's not enough life. We want more and more and more life.
But, says Hogg, along comes an incurable virus that screams, "You can't have the life you had before," and people get angry. He's counseling them to allow COVID-19 to spark them into re-examining their priorities and to spend more time doing things that fire their passion and inspire them, and most of all, to enjoy life with the people they love. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The African Union's special envoys have raised billions of U.S. dollars to help the continent respond to the COVID-19 pandemic. They're also trying to get debt relief from member states, and they've set up a procurement platform to address any shortages of personal protective gear, testing kits, and ventilators. The envoys were appointed in April by AU Chair, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa. They include Nigeria's former finance minister, Dr. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, and South Africa's former finance minister, Trevor Manuel. Reporter Vicky Stark spoke to Manuel.
Manuel says while there are various envelopes of money donated to the AU to fight COVID-19, the envoys have managed to secure commitments of $54 billion to Africa, of which $30 billion has already been disbursed. Manuel adds that among others, they've also been in talks with the World Bank, the IMF, and G20 member states like China to get debt relief for countries. He says while theirs isn't the only such initiative, to date it's been fairly successful.
The key target that we as envoys have put in place is to try and ensure that countries can get a minimum of 2 years of debt standstill and that the interest not paid for the 2 years not be capitalized thereafter. Africa spends between $35 and $44 billion a year on debt service costs. And if we can get the, call it $40 billion a year, not paid, it is money that stays on the continent and that money can be used as part of the initiative to fight the COVID pandemic.
He says Envoy Strive Masiyiwa, a Zimbabwean businessman, is also heading the team that has launched a procurement platform for PPEs. It was piloted in Rwanda and, according to Manuel, it could be similar to Amazon.
Maintaining the platform is done primarily through donations from private philanthropy, the big foundations, Gates, Carnegie, Ford, etc., are involved in that, and it doesn't compel countries to procure through the platform, but clearly there is a significant price advantage if they do.
He says it places a variety of goods at the disposal of countries, and these would vary with time and circumstance.
From test kits to personal protective equipment to medical equipment such as ventilators and so on. And presumably in the future, there will be an opportunity to purchase medicines.
Asked what the AU was doing about a vaccine, Manuel said they're pushing for intellectual property rights to be transcended.
We know, for instance, that 50 years ago, the research for the flu vaccine was done primarily at universities from public funding. And so the flu vaccine is availed across the world without an emphasis on the profit motive. We'd like to have something similar so that the cost of production and some research costs are repaid on a vaccine. But if you have a battle and very strong nationalism in the treatment of vaccines as and when they become available, it's going to be a major negative for global development. And that is an initiative led by a number of heads of state. I certainly sat in on meetings where this has been taken up. It's involved a number of African heads of state, European heads of state, Canada, Mexico, China, and so on. The U.S. has excluded itself from that initiative, unfortunately, but there's still work to be done in this regard.
The envoys were expected to meet with China's foreign minister today. This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America News in Cape Town.
Burundi is set to swear in newly elected president Evariste Ndayishimiye tomorrow. The French news agency AFP, quoting the country's foreign ministry, said the sudden death of the incumbent president Pierre Nkurunziza forced authorities to expedite the swearing-in ceremony 2 months early. The foreign ministry has sent invitations to diplomats and foreign organizations to take part in the ceremony tomorrow in the capital, Gitega. Ndayishimiye, 52, is a former general and a Hutu rebel, like his predecessor, and was handpicked by the powerful ruling party. He won the May election with 68.7% of the vote and has been scheduled to take office in August. With recent droughts in recent years, Zimbabwe is a prime focus on World Day to combat desertification and drought. Reporter Kuzai Zanawashi looks at the impact, especially on food security.
Niels Bolzer is the deputy director for the World Food Program, or WFP. He explains the drought situation in Zimbabwe.
Zimbabwe has faced three droughts over the past 5 years, which have had a detrimental impact on the agricultural yields, and it has particularly affected smallhold farmers that rely on their own harvest for feeding themselves.
Bolzer says projections of this harvesting season are particularly worrying.
Unfortunately, it's not looking good. As I mentioned, it's substantially less than half of what is needed in terms of the grain output, and the prospects of the next harvest season, that's again 2020-21, are currently being analyzed. We hope it's going to look better than this current one.
Bolzer says WFP has had to extend its lean season support, which normally would have been winding down in April, when communities normally start harvesting. That is not the case this year. Pondering a way forward, Bolzer says small grain crops stand a better chance of growing in a drought.
Zimbabwe has a very rich history of a broad variety of drought-resistant crops that have been grown in the past. Unfortunately, the focus has shifted more on maize in particular that is more susceptible to droughts. So we have been promoting over the years, working with smallhold farmers, the use of small grains, sorghum, millet, cowpeas, etc., etc.
He says the effort has been a success. He says WFP also has been helping communities combat drought by helping them build dams and irrigation systems. Small grain farming still has its challenges, with some farmers looking down upon such crops and associate them with chicken feed instead of being part of a balanced diet. While WFP has set its targets on bringing aid to food insecure Zimbabweans, he says they need more funding to reach everyone they have targeted. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashi from Harare.
Egypt has arrested a veteran journalist who has been openly critical of the government after he appeared on the Qatar-based Al Jazeera network. The Committee to Protect Journalists said Mohamed Monir, former deputy editor of the pro-government Seventh Day newspaper, has been in custody for 15 days on charges of joining a terrorist organization, spreading false news, and misusing social media.
Those are pro forma charges. The Egyptian government have levied them against many journalists as a way to keep them in custody and arbitrary detention, many for years without a chance to see a judge and without a chance to defend themselves. Out of the 26 journalists we found in custody in December last year, 23 journalists were charged with those same charges, politically motivated mass trials. The charges represent a continuation of a pattern where Egyptian government have used vague anti-terrorism and false news charges to try and crack down on critical, independent, and now even pro-government media. If any of the journalists or the outlets, their question or raise objections about the government actions and behavior.
So what's the rank of Egypt in the Press Freedom Index, and how would you describe the status of freedom of speech in Egypt?
Egypt was third worst jailer of journalists in December after Turkey and China, and it has maintained that spot of being one of the top worst jailer of journalists worldwide since 2013. However, the government have continued to deploy even more censorship tools. Starting with 2015, they have started blocking and threatening and shutting down and fining online media and news outlet that has traditionally been allowed to operate on the internet. Now more than 500 websites, include dozens of news websites, have been blocked. And more recently, the government have been expanding their censorship tool by utilizing several government regulatory, including the High Council of Media, the State Information Regulatory, to try and even threaten foreign journalists, those who cover news from outside the country. Now we see Egypt expelling the Guardian correspondent, threatening the New York Times and the Washington Post reporters. All are basically desperate attempts to silence anyone who can criticize the government handling of the pandemic.
When the COVID-19 pandemic started, the Committee to Protect Journalists called for the release of imprisoned journalists in Egypt to protect them from infection. What was the Egyptian government response?
The Egyptian government have acted in the worst possible way. Most governments, even some in the Middle East, have tried and dismissed and released a lot of journalists, including Iran, Bahrain. But Egypt have actually went on the opposite direction, arresting more journalists and detaining more of them on pretrial detentions without evidence. Last month alone, we documented at least 5 cases of journalists, majority of whom were commenting or reporting on the pandemic. But the case of Mohammed Munir specifically shows how cruel the government is willing to be. Mohammed Munir is a 65-year-old. His health is deteriorating. He has heart condition, diabetic, and the fact that in this dangerous medical state, they decide to put him in pretrial detention just shows how disregard the government have for his health.
Sharif, help us understand how the Egyptian media is suppressed when the Egyptian constitution clearly secures freedom of the press.
The constitution in Egypt have always included guarantees of freedom of speech and freedom of the press. However, even within the constitution, there is always an exception that those freedoms are restricted by law. And those laws, including penal code, law of publications, and others, have always included restrictions on journalists and on freedom of speech. The Constitution just have flowery language. It does not necessarily provide any protection against government abuse.
VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi discussed with Sharif Mansour, MENA program coordinator at the Committee to Protect Journalists, those charges and the rank of Egypt in the Press Freedom Index as one of the world's top jailers of journalists. That was Sharif Mansour, MENA program coordinator at the Committee to Protect Journalists, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Uganda's Electoral Commission has banned mass rallies ahead of general elections planned for early next year. It says the move is in line with President Yoweri Museveni's directive banning public rallies and mass gatherings to stem the spread of COVID-19. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Ugandans will be going to the polls between January 10th and February 8th to elect the president and parliamentary representatives. Usually, the campaign period is characterized by huge rallies as candidates traverse the country in search for votes. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, this time, the campaigns are to be done through the use of information technology and communication. Justice Simon Byabakama Mugenyi is the Electoral Commission chairperson.
Given the COVID-19 pandemic and the health risks involved, it cannot be business as usual. There will have to be some different modes which will have to be adopted. Since the gathering of the people or masses is a high-risk aspect of person-to-person transmission of the virus, the usual mass rallies will not be entertained, and the candidates will be advised to conduct their campaigns using the media.
Opposition candidates see the move as a deliberate effort to stifle their campaigns. Asman Basalira is an opposition legislator and supporter of presidential hopeful Robert Kyagulanyi, a.k.a. Bobi Wine, who has drawn large crowds of mostly youthful followers.
In our constitution, there is nothing like a scientific election. Either we have an election the normal way, or we don't have an election at all. We are talking about engaging people through rallies, and you are saying there cannot be any rally. The Electoral Commission has not told us how the voting is going to be conducted, how you can conduct voting in one day using the social distancing method.
He says all stakeholders in the electoral process should have been consulted before a decision was made.
Ideally, we should have sat and agreed on some of the proposals they made today. But if we, the stakeholders, are outside their programs, then they are making the program for who? So I think it's important that the stakeholders are involved, the stakeholders are consulted for the good of the country.
The ruling National Resistance Movement, NRM Party, welcomed the Electoral Commission directive.
But of course we must appreciate that there was no third option. We either had to go the traditional way of campaigns, or we had to adopt the scientific one. And for us to go for the traditional one would mean putting lives of Ugandans to a very big risk.
The presidential nominations are set to be held between 2nd and 3rd November. Museveni, who has been in power since 1986, is expected to seek another term after his party endorsed him as their sole party flag bearer for the presidency last year. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Yabaro, thank you for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
Brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bongo music to hip life, bongo flavor to sukus, Afrobeat. Martin Dumbolo and Makosa Tokwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09.05 and 20.05 UTC right after the international news.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.